Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is the British sculptor Rebecca Stevenson. Rebecca's chief material of choice is wax, which she uses as a precursor for casting in bronze, but mainly for the material itself. Using resin as well, she fashions the wax into modern-day versions of old Vanitas paintings from the Baroque period, those still lifes full of objects like skulls, game birds, fruit and wilting flowers, all a reminder of life's fragility, and that no matter who we are, we're all mortal. Many of her works exuberate with highly coloured flowers and fruit, meticulously carved in wax, and which spill from the innards of swans or hares, or are strewn across human busts, echoing the bitter sweetness of their Baroque antecedents. Last year, Rebecca completed an artist residency at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, where some of her works were already housed. They're also in the Marimotti and Craft collections, as well as lots of private ones. I spoke to Rebecca from her London studio. Rebecca Stevenson, nice to see you again, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about your background, Rebecca. Are you speaking to me from London? Are you a Londoner?
I'm not originally a Londoner, but I have been in London for many, many years. I was born and brought up just outside of London in Sussex.
And was it from an artistic background?
Not especially, but my parents were always kind of very interested in literature, in history, in museums, and also in sort of the countryside. And I was always encouraged a lot to be creative and be artistic as a child.
And so you were a bit of a maker, were you always?
Very much so, yeah.
What, Lego?
No, more like making and inventing things with fabric and paper and whatever I could get my hands on, really. Yeah.
Oh, really? What sort of things did you make?
Oh, God, this is very embarrassing.
Oh, great. Go on.
I was just very crafty. I was a very crafty child. I do remember asking my mother if I could convert the cupboard under the stairs into a kind of studio at one point, which she said a firm no to. And then later on, I remember taking over my parents' garage and taping lots of brown paper on the wall and doing very large, strange oil paintings. I think making things was always really important to me, kind of having your hands on some kind of material, some kind of stuff.
So when did you first become aware of sculpture as an art form?
The first time I remember being excited about sculpture, I think I went on a school trip to see a Henry Moore exhibition at the Royal Academy. And that's the first time I remember kind of having a kind of moment of excitement or understanding about sculpture. And there were these enormous bronzes, which were kind of sort of very contained in the sort of spaces of the gallery. They were almost sort of too big for the gallery spaces. They kind of filled them. And I was really excited by just that kind of sense of a presence.
How old were you then?
I'm guessing I was maybe like, I don't know, 16 maybe. Maybe 16, 17.
And did that help determine your ambition to become an artist?
Not so much at that point. I think that's the first time that I remember that kind of encounter with sculpture as a form. And then I think later on, when I went to do my foundation course, at that point, I started to kind of understand a little bit more about contemporary sculpture. But I didn't go straight into art education after leaving school. I had some years away. I always had the drive and the desire to pursue a career as an artist, but it took me a while to find my way there.
Mm. You eventually went to Chelsea and then after the Royal College of Art. I think I'm right in saying you became fascinated with anatomical dissection.
Yes.
Was that at either one of those art schools?
That was really when I was at the Royal College. We had an option at that time to do some sort of anatomical training. You know, historically, of course, all artists would have done that as part of their training.
Yeah, it's died out a bit, hasn't it, really?
Yes, it has. It's fallen out of favour along with all those kind of traditional kind of ways of learning figurative art and figurative sculpture. So I was trying to make figurative sculpture quite badly, and I felt that if I studied some anatomy, it would help me with that. But what happened when I began to study was that the anatomy itself became the kind of subject of the work. And the idea of the internal body, the internal landscapes of the body, became this kind of powerful drive behind the work, in a way, became the subject of the work.
I suppose alongside that is a fascination with mortality.
Yes, that certainly plays into it. I think it's something kind of very profound when you are when you are stood in a dissecting room looking at a cadaver, looking at a partly dissected body. You know, you are looking at the end. You're looking at death kind of face to face. Face to flesh, flesh to flesh. So, you know, that's a very powerful experience. And I think anyone who, you know, whether you're an artist or someone in the medical profession, you know, anyone who's kind of had that encounter, that experience, changes you radically. I felt like that moment when we were studying, you know, there was this kind of opportunity. So we would go kind of to UCL once a week, and we would have these kind of sessions, we would have lectures, and then we would have these drawing sessions in the dissecting room. And I think, you know, there was like week one, there was like everybody was there, you know. And then like week two, not so many people. And you know, I mean, it is a very difficult, I think there's a kind of morbid fascination, which is kind of natural, but then I think it's quite difficult to kind of continue to stay with it.
Those were the strongest stomachs prevailed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't ever want to eat much lunch afterwards.
And is that also where you first got attracted to wax as a substance? Because wax was often used, wasn't it, for centuries as models for anatomical research?
Yeah. So there is this extraordinary history of wax as a material in sculpture, and particularly in the use for making, you know, in some cases, these really exquisite, astonishing anatomical models and phantoms. Yeah, I mean, I was already working with wax. I'd started working with wax very early. It's a very accessible material. So it's a material that, you know, you can get your hands on easily and you can work with easily. So I'd started with it when I was on my foundation course, actually. And I've been working with it all the way through. But at that point, when I started to do the anatomical drawing, when I started to be interested also in the whole history of anatomical art, and then also, you know, this connection with the kind of the wax anatomies, particularly in the kind of 17th, 18th century, was also a very strong influence in the work.
Mm. I'm going to throw a few quotes at you in this interview, your own quotes. First one is that I make sculpture to better understand what it is to be made of flesh, to be a body. So that's all part of your anatomical research then, is it?
It is. And although the work that I make now is not kind of explicitly anatomical or even about explicitly a representative of the body, the human body, you know, for me, there's this idea that, you know, sculpture and the body are kind of intimately connected. And, you know, you asked me about my first experience of sculpture, and that experience is me, my body, next to this kind of monumental object, the kind of interaction of these kind of two bodies, these two forms in space. So for me, all sculpture kind of comes back to that.
And what have you learnt then?
I'm still learning. I think it's this idea about kind of trying to understand, you know, we live in a world where we live in our minds, we live in our screens, we're very visual, we kind of often a bit disconnected from our bodies until something goes wrong with them, maybe. So I think it's this idea of trying to kind of be very present in that kind of physicality. And for me, that's what sculpture should do. You know, it should kind of somehow pull you back into your kind of physical body, as well as working on the mind, as well as having an intellectual dimension, of course. So, you know, qualities that I'm really interested in are things like longevity, impermanence, softness, hardness, vulnerability, strength. And that's something, no matter what I'm making in terms of subjects, that's something that I'm trying to kind of embed into the work, into the materials, with the choice of materials as well.
And you also create these wounds, as they've been called. You dissect your sculptures so that you can implant fruit, flowers, and all the rest of it. That came directly, I suppose, from watching anatomical dissection.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a kind of direct result of that experience and that time. And I began making these wax bodies that were layered with many, many layers of colored wax, and then kind of creating these wounds, as you said. So kind of cutting, manipulating, peeling back, folding back layers. And this is a technique that I still use, I still employ. It's not perhaps at the moment, it's not perhaps the absolute sort of crux of the practice. But again, it's a kind of anchor point. It's a kind of sort of grounding point in the practice for sure.
Right. Another quote. My works enact and parody both the act of femininity, that's preening and prettifying makeup and so on, and hysteria, with its contortions, flip-flopping between seduction and ugliness, its clowning, its absurdity. There's a lot going on there, isn't there?
Yes.
Go on, explain.
Okay. Yeah, you are really putting me on the spot here, Bob. Yeah, I mean, I think as with the anatomical aspect of the work, there's a kind of aspect of feminist theory that underpins the work. It's not always explicit. It's not necessary to kind of understand or wish to understand that theory in order to relate to the work. But for me, again, it's one of the scaffolds that's supporting the practice, if you like. It's one of the kind of foundations of the practice. So when I was studying, I was really interested in kind of French feminists and the idea of femininity as a performance, which I think is something that's kind of quite current actually in contemporary culture, particularly with the kind of interest in drag in contemporary culture. There's this kind of very kind of awareness of the sort of performance of femininity. Sculpture historically is a kind of quite a masculine form, and it's associated with these kind of masculine, if you like, attributes of sort of heroism, monumentalism, durability, monumentality. So if you imagine a kind of a big statue of a general on a horse in a town square, you know, I think for me, when I was sort of younger, that's maybe what I thought sculpture was, you know. So when I'm working, I'm kind of always kind of working in response to this and kind of countering this. And I've often used decoration or kind of prettiness quite consciously in the work as a way to sort of disrupt that idea.
So it's the subtlety of exuberance and colour, I suppose.
Yes, and also things like surface, the use of decoration, detail, the use of kind of floral motifs in the work, particularly roses, which I use a lot, the use of the color pink, which is very important. I did go through a phase when I tried to make works that didn't have any pink in them, but it came out anyway. again, very, very current.
It's very Barbie.
Barbie summer that we've had, yeah.
Yeah. The other obvious influence on your work are the Vanitas pictures that's so popular from, you know, the 17th century, particularly with Dutch artists. I'm fascinated by Vanitas pictures, actually. You have these earthly symbols all cramped together. a kind of austere message, isn't it, sending out, you know, sort of moralizing that, you know, all life is temporary and ephemeral, you know, therefore you've got to act with accordance to God or whatever. You've kind of updated this, haven't you? What's your interpretation of Vanitas?
For me, I think it's both that kind of, it's both kind of sobering and liberating. You know, yes, you know, again, we live in a world where we don't really want to think about death and dying. We kind of shove it to the edges of our consciousness and our culture and then only engage with it when we have to. So there is an idea about bringing that kind of awareness, bringing it into your consciousness. You know, this for me is quite kind of, it's, I don't want to sound like I'm dictating this to somebody who's viewing my art. You know, this for me is something quite personal that I'm kind of practicing in a way. And I'm not a Buddhist, but I know there are many Buddhist practices where you contemplate mortality as a way to kind of liberate yourself in the moment. So the flip side of the sort of the morbidity of it is that it liberates you to kind of enjoy what you have and revel in what you have. And again, you know, I think kind of going right back to that key experience of drawing from the cadavers and the dissecting room, you know, I often would walk out of there and be kind of really on some kind of high. And I think the high is, wow, I'm alive. And I have all this kind of potential to experience pleasure and joy and emotions and sensations in my physical body. And, you know, the flip side of the vanitas is that you have those kind of wonderful heaps of fruit that make your mouth water. You know, it is the kind of let's feast on it.
Yes, I can see what you mean. Is there an element of protest against conspicuous consumption and excess, do you think, in those vanitas pictures?
I think you can read it in that way. And I think also that's something that's interesting to think about for us, because, again, we're at this moment where, you know, we've all been encouraged to conspicuously consume and define ourselves through material possessions and to, you know, enjoy luxuries and pleasures. And now I think many of us are at a moment where we're kind of being forced to question all of that because of the toll that it's taking on the planet. So, you know, again, I think there is that kind of idea of, you know, it's quite a kind of ambivalent kind of moment. You know, the vanitas at this moment has quite a kind of particular meaning if you kind of filter it through sort of what we're experiencing now.
It's interesting because I spent a few years living in the Netherlands, and I noticed there's still a Puritan streak that runs through Dutch society in the sense, in a good sense, in this, I think, because they don't like to show off wealth. They're not very ostentatious in that respect.
And I think, you know, all cultures have a different relationship to that. Yeah, I think there's an element of sort of British culture, which is also perhaps like that. But there is also there is also this kind of idea that you flaunt it. And also with social media, there's the idea that if you haven't got it, you kind of pretend you have and you flaunt it anyway.
Mm.
You know, you kind of you borrow someone's penthouse apartment and you buy some designer clothes, photograph yourself, take them back to the shop, you know, it's really interesting. It's complex and interesting, and that idea as well of kind of spectacle and display, which is again bound up with the kind of the vanitas, the kind of, you know, think about a beautiful enormous vanitas still life painting on the wall of a wealthy merchant's house in Baroque Holland. You know, it's like that person's displaying. They're displaying their wealth and their abundance.
Yes, I was thinking when I was thinking about the way you've updated Vanitas to a modern audience, so to speak. You've obviously made them 3D, and you've made them a lot more colourful and so on. I just wondered whether those earthly symbols might now include Rolex watches or sports cars or something.
Yeah, you're not going to see those in my work anytime soon.
The Baroque period, do you think it's often misunderstood? I mean, we always think of Baroque as sort of, you know, quite exuberant and lots of flowing, you know, ostentation. But it has another side to it, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it certainly does. I think, you know, that the term Baroque has become a bit of a sort of shorthand for sort of, yeah, sort of flowing, billowing, elaborate gilded drapery, I think, you know. And that's one aspect of it. But yes, of course, it also has this dark side in thinking about, you know, the Baroque as a kind of art historical term, as a kind of description of a period. You know, you have all this kind of turbulence going on across Europe. And, you know, there is in Baroque art, there's also a lot of darkness for sure.
I'd like to talk a little about your process, Rebecca. You start modelling presumably in clay, do you, with an armature and so on?
Yeah. The process is quite long, but essentially I'm starting with quite a traditional approach where I'm building an armature and then I'm modelling in clay over that. And then I take a mould from that clay sculpture and then I cast into whatever material I'm going to use. But I mean, that usually involves wax, because if I'm going to cast into metal, then I'll make a wax object first. So I'll cast into wax or wax with resin. At the moment, I'm also working quite a lot with plaster polymers as well. And then once I've got my cast, I'll rework it. I often use the phrase unmaking. I often see the process as kind of divided between a period of making and a period of unmaking. And that might involve this process of dissection or wounding that we spoke about earlier. It might involve fragmenting something, inverting it, opening it up, adding elements, removing elements. So, you know, there's this kind of balance between this very controlled, quite traditional sort of figurative modeling stage, and then this stage where things kind of change and are disrupted and unmade. And at that point, it's also about kind of my dialogue with the material very, very much. And I'm increasingly interested in kind of seeing what the material will do, seeing what it won't do, seeing what it allows me and does not allow me.
And you're still learning on that?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you give your pieces quite a lot of glaze, don't you? Very shiny.
Yeah, I often use a lot of resins, varnishes, waxes, that kind of thing on the surface. You know, surface is very important.
Is that to give any particular effect? I mean, I read somewhere that you were imitating sugar.
Yeah. I've been very interested for a long time in the history of food, and you know, food is what, you know, food and the body, food enters the body, we are kind of made of what we eat. Yeah, really interested for a long time in sugar sculpture, which was very big in the Baroque period, and you had very extraordinary, elaborate, huge objects made of sugar for banquets and so on, often designed by the very most famous sculptors of the day. So that's been a big influence on the work. And I have often used materials and manipulated them to look like sugar or other food stuff. So yes, you might have very glossy surfaces that look like kind of glaze that you would get on a tart or a patisserie or something like that. You have kind of sugary surfaces. You have kind of trompe l'oeil fruit. I've always been quite interested in the idea that the sculpture could kind of provoke a kind of visceral physical response as well as a visual or aesthetic response. So, you know, in the same way that when you look at the beautiful Vanitas painting with the piles of fruit, maybe it makes your mouth water a little bit. Mm. So it's kind of interacting with the viewer on a lot of different levels.
Your bronze works, though, are a lot more muted, aren't they? I suppose that makes them feel more grounded. Is this, as you say, you would balance, you have a certain balance in your work. Is this a kind of balanced to the exuberant wax and resin works?
Yeah, it is, I guess. I think, you know, for me, the materials that I work with have very particular kind of meanings. They have very particular resonances. I do tend to, as far as possible, I like to work with materials that have a kind of history, that have a kind of meaning throughout the history of sculpture. So yes, with the bronzes, there's a very different quality. There's a very different quality, and it's something that I'm kind of working with more actually at the moment. I'm really interested in the magical kind of transformation that happens when you create a work in bronze. The transformation of the wax to the bronze, this kind of alchemy almost, such a endlessly kind of fascinating, powerful process.
Rebecca, I must ask you about your artist in residence at the V&A. What was the brief?
The brief was really very exciting. So as you probably know, last year the V&A hosted a fabulous Donatello exhibition. So this exhibition had been kind of, there were kind of three different iterations of this exhibition. It began in Florence, then moved to Berlin, and then the third sort of, each time it changed a little bit. And the third exhibition was at the V&A last year. Because they'd loaned many works to this exhibition, they had a particular room in the medieval and Renaissance section of the museum that was quite empty, because many objects had been loaned out. So the brief was to respond to those absences. So absolutely respond to those absences as a sculptor in whatever way. So I was obviously very excited and very inspired by this. It was a kind of dream opportunity for me.
Well, let's have a look at one of those responses. Donatello's David has his foot on the head of Goliath, yes. And you've responded by creating your own Goliath. What was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I will say, you know, though it obviously is a kind of dream project for any sculptor with an interest in art history, it's also incredibly intimidating. I mean, how do you respond to Donatello? it's quite a challenge. And I did want to respond to the David because it is this iconic object that almost everybody knows, almost everybody recognizes. You know, some of his other works are a lot more obscure. They're not well known. This is the one. So I really love the idea of, you know, the myth of David and Goliath, the weak triumphing over the strong, the young shepherd boy who triumphs over this giant. And in Donatello's version, you know, he does look like a young boy. Unlike in Michelangelo's version, he really does look like a young boy. And I really like the idea of, I mean, the image of the severed head comes up a lot in medieval and Renaissance art. Walking around that section of the museum, I noticed it's quite a recurring motif. So I just like that image as an idea of this kind of image of power and a patriarchal, aggressive power being kind of overthrown. So that was why I decided to work with that as a kind of motif. And I based the head loosely on the Goliath's head from Donatello's sculpture, but I also looked at other objects like his Judith and Holofernes and some of the heads of John the Baptist sculpted in alabaster, which is, again, quite a common subject at that period in art history.
And the head is lying horizontally.
Yeah, the head is lying horizontally. If you look at the Donatello version, the head is lying horizontally. He's got his foot on the head. And David is sculpted you know, with this incredible sort of sensuous beauty. But the Goliath's head in the Donatello version looks quite kind of, it looks almost like a kind of prop, you know, it reminds me of something almost from a kind of B-movie prop, you know, it's kind of, he has, you know, the modeling is much less refined. The way that he deals with the chopped off neck is quite strange and quite interesting, actually, from a nerdy sculpture point of view. So, yeah, I also use the head kind of turned on the side. So, again, you just have that idea of something that's fallen, that's toppled. You know, it's, you know, as soon as a sculpture is on its side, it kind of has lost its kind of heroic kind of nature, you know. And I was thinking a lot about sculptures that get pushed over, toppled over. You know, we've seen a lot of sculptures intentionally toppled as a sort of political statement in recent years.
Oh, that, so that kind of chimed with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Last quote. My perspective of myself as an artist has shifted over the course of the residency, and I just wondered in what way.
I think in many ways that I'm still digesting, actually. It's such an extraordinary thing to kind of work within a collection like the V&A, within a museum like the V&A. It's so extraordinary to engage with this kind of history every single day. I mean, it's done two things, you know. In some ways, it's given my confidence a huge boost, and it's also humbled me. And I think the two things are kind of both very, very powerful. You know, it's incredibly humbling to walk through the cast courts every single morning on your way to your studio. You know, if you're having a bad time with your work, actually, it can be quite difficult. In some ways, it's easier to just be kind of, you know, to not look at something. But at the same time, it's been so inspiring and so empowering for me. And it's also opened up a whole kind of different avenue of practice and a whole different way of working, which I'm still just starting to explore now.
So your future sculptures will have brought in these influences?
I hope so. I think so. I think it can't not, actually. And the works that I'm developing now are definitely kind of bringing in a lot more of the research that I was doing at the museum and the works and the objects that I were looking at there. And we'll be showing these works with James Freeman Gallery in the summer. So there'll be a solo exhibition. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
Right, so your learning process has accelerated. Thanks so much, Rebecca, for talking about it. It's been lovely listening to you.
Thank you.
Rebecca Stevenson with her ever-evolving artistic practice. I hope you enjoyed it. Join me, Bob Chaundy, to consider more art next week.